Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for standing by, and welcome to the Risky Women, Disrupting Simple Notions of Women's HIV Risk webinar. During this presentation, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and if you should have a question at that time, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You can also use the chat feature located in the lower left corner of your screen. If you need to reach an operator, please press star 0. As a reminder, today's conference is being recorded on Monday, December the 9th, 2013. I would now like to turn the conference over to Anna Forbes. Please proceed.
Hello, everyone. On behalf of the U.S. Women in PrEP Working Group, thank you very much for your patience, and I'm turning it over to Vanetta Charles, Senior Vice President of AIDS United, who will be our moderator today.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the call. Thank you all participants for joining. We had over 500 people register, and we're hoping to get to that in terms of participation, but even that just original expression of interest is testimony to the fact that this is critical information, and we are so pleased to have such an esteemed panel today. I will take a moment to review the agenda and forgive the 5-minute delay because we had a little bit of technical difficulties, but I think they're all here and resolved. So if you can see the slide on your screen, there will be a Q&A after all the speakers have presented. So please hold your questions until after the presentation. There are a number of ways that you can ask the question right before we go into the Q&A portion. I will call the operator back onto the line who will run through the various ways that you can ask questions, but they are outlined in bullet form already here on this slide for you. The webinar will be recorded, and webinar recordings will be available at the website that is available on the screen right now. And I'm assuming that you have all dialed in via phone, if you can hear me. We're already getting some questions via the chat function, so please keep those coming. To review the agenda quickly, the introduction is by me, and I'm speaking right now. Then Anna Forbes will give an overview of the U.S. Women in PrEP Working Group, and then we have three esteemed presenters that will go through some interesting notions on risk and the calculus of risk assessment for women as relates to pre-exposure prophylaxis. I'll introduce each speaker before they speak. But you can see their names and esteemed titles right now. Then we'll launch into the Q&A, and again, we will give an overview right before the Q&A on the various ways that you can ask questions before the call. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Anna, who will talk about the U.S. Women in PrEP Working Group.
Hi, everybody. I'm the coordinator for the U.S. Women in PrEP Working Group. I work as a consultant for several organizations, and very fortunately for me, one of those is Sister Love, which is hosting, together with AVAC, hosting the U.S. Women in PrEP Working Group. I just want to tell you a little bit about the group. For those of you who are new to it, this will be very brief, and then move on to our presentations. We have been meeting since March 2012. The group was convened by Daison Dixangelo, Sister Love, in March when the FDA announced that they would be considering approval of Truvada as PrEP. And we came together because many of us were concerned about what this would mean for women in the U.S., particularly given the results of two clinical trials, well, one at the time, FemPrep at the time, and later the VOICE trial, both of which appeared to show that PrEP was not particularly effective among women. It seems now as though those results may have had more to do with women's adherence to taking the drug during the clinical trial and the fact that it didn't work, obviously, for those who weren't taking it, than it had to do with the drug's biological effectiveness among women, which has been fine in trials in which women were taking it. But in any event, many of us were concerned about what PrEP rollout would mean for women in the U.S., so a group of people came together at Daison's invitation to talk about this, and we were conscious from the outset of putting together a group that really reflected the diversity of women interested in this, including women who were working in HIV/AIDS, women who were women's health advocates, researchers, policymakers in PrEP, and people who were working, women who were working in other biomedical prevention options for women. The group has certainly not been exclusive to women, but it has been primarily women coming together to discuss this, and there are now about 70 group members. We have never made a clear-cut definition of who, what characteristics you have to be a group member. It's been a group comprised of everyone who's interested in being involved in it. We have had face-to-face meetings annually and teleconference meetings as needed, which generally has happened once every few months. Next slide, please. Next slide. Thank you. So where are we with PrEP today? I'm assuming everyone on the call knows that PrEP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis, and it's the process of taking an antiretroviral drug currently on a daily basis for those who are using it among people who are HIV negative in order to reduce the risk of becoming HIV positive if you're exposed to HIV. And as I said, the FDA has approved PrEP, Truvada, the only drug that's been approved for PrEP so far, approved it for use in the United States in June 2012, and the debate continues nationally and globally about what this means and what we actually know about PrEP and what we don't. Some of the big debate questions include issues of adherence. As I mentioned, it's clear that there are factors that make it easier for some people to adhere to taking a pill every day than for others, and there are concerns about how those factors affect PrEP rollout and who can use it effectively and who cannot. There are certainly issues of access, especially globally. In the United States right now, PrEP is available and covered by most insurance methods. It's covered by Medicaid, and Gilead, the company that manufactures PrEP, also has a patient assistance program that it makes it available to people for whom doctors prescribe it and who have no other way of getting access to it. But adherence in terms of knowing about PrEP and feeling it, that one has access to it is still an issue. There are questions about gender guidelines. There are questions about risk and safety effects in taking PrEP, whether there are any gender-based differences. And there are also questions that we've been discussing quite a bit about a national coordinated plan for PrEP, which is something that the working group would like to see. Finally, there is research ongoing and discussion ongoing about other formats in which it might be possible to use PrEP. For example, there's research to determine whether it can be used intermittently, which would be a scenario like someone taking it before a weekend if they anticipate going out and having sex over the weekend, or taking it when they get together with a partner that they only see occasionally, et cetera, and whether it's whether it's possible to create injectable PrEP. There's research going on to see if it's possible to administer PrEP by injection every few months. Next slide, please. Okay. Why a U.S. Women's Working Group on PrEP? We thought that there really needed to be a national response by women about women's concerns on PrEP, and that is largely because there have still to date not been any trials done in the United States among U.S. cis women or women born biologically female on PrEP. All of the trials that have involved women have been offshore, been international trials. There have been trials involving transgender women, which Joanne Keatley will be discussing in more depth. But we felt that we really there wasn't a lot of knowledge about what PrEP would mean for most U.S. women, and we wanted to raise that voice. We felt that there was a need for women's concerns about PrEP safety, effectiveness, and accessibility to women that needed to be addressed. And we thought that the best way to do this was by educating and engaging civil society partners and healthcare providers in the PrEP discourse and policy development, so that discussion was going beyond researchers and into the communities where PrEP would be used and among the healthcare providers who would be prescribing it. And our tools, as with any advocacy group, are inquiry, raising the relevant questions, advocacy, taking positions and advocating for those positions, and accountability, holding the government and other policymakers accountable for what they've agreed to in terms of PrEP. Next slide, please. So our first major step in that direction was creating a women's working group statement, and you can find that document online. The web link for all of the documents related to the working group is shown on that first slide. And in our statement, which took 9 months of writing and something like 19 versions, it was incredibly labor-intensive, but very, very thorough, I'm happy to say, we articulated a pathway that we thought would make sense in terms of responding to the questions that we were posing. We called very strongly for civil society engagement, as I said. We called for a national plan for provider education and social marketing about PrEP. We called for a concrete plan developed jointly between government and civil society for incorporating PrEP education and access for women into the national HIV/AIDS strategy. And we called for a process that included milestones, feedback mechanisms, resources, and accountability to actually make this happen. Next slide, please. We also called for a meeting with the federal officials responsible for the issues we were addressing, including the Office on National AIDS Policy, the CDC, the Department of Health and Human Services, et cetera. And we got a meeting with them last April, I'm happy to say. We felt that they were very responsive and that we released the statement at the beginning of March and got the meeting within 6 weeks. We had an important discussion with federal officials. This group of six of us that you see in the picture are the ones who were attending the meeting on behalf of the working group. And we discussed the statement really in some depth, and we thought that they were pretty attentive to that, stressing the issues about provider education and interagency coordination that I mentioned before. And we got a commitment from them for a prompt response. They said they would respond within weeks rather than months, which we thought was very encouraging in terms of the federal government. Next slide, please. And the upshot, of course, was that we got some of what we wanted and not all of what we wanted, which is very often the case. We received a great deal of very helpful information about the plans that these federal agencies had for PrEP among women, research that was ongoing. We got a very gratifying response that the first implementation pilot program to enroll U.S. women, cis women, in a PrEP pilot was now fully funded. That was a pilot that had been pending for 2 years without sufficient funding to move forward, and we found that there had been a commitment to full funding for it, and it's moving forward, which is a very exciting development, and we really welcome that. And we expect to have a report, or we hope to have a report on what's happening with that implementation pilot in our January conference call. We did not, however, get a positive response on our request for an interagency collaborative working group that would involve civil society and federal agencies. We were told that that planning was already happening and that a new working group to address it was not going to be created. So there are still things that we want, but there are certainly areas in which we're making progress. And this last slide is just to give you some sense of the growing visibility that we've also been able to achieve over the last year or so. As you see, this is the third of three webinars that we've done this year. We've had increasing visibility at conferences and in the media. The working group was at the U.S. Conference on AIDS, at CROI last March, and at the International Association of Providers of AIDS Care in London last September, where we presented a poster called High-Risk U.S. Women in PrEP. That poster reflects the results of a community dialogue groups that we did with 100 U.S. women, focusing specifically on women who use drugs and or women who do sex work and or women who are transgender. And those results were very interesting. We also got some coverage. The second illustration down is coverage we got in a journal called Positively Aware, and coverage in RH Reality Check and various other venues where people interested in HIV and women's health are reading. So we're happy that awareness of what we're doing is growing. As I say, membership in the working group at this point is based on who wants to be in it. So if you're interested in participating, get in touch with us and let us know. My address, which is annaforbes@earthlink.net, is on virtually all of the written materials we've prepared, which you can find online. And I hope that's a helpful orientation to the group. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Anna. That was very helpful. And in spite of a little bit of a late start, we're actually right on time. So That's great. And for those of you, we're seeing people are rolling in as participants. And for those of you who just joined, there will be opportunities to ask questions after all of the presenters have spoken. And we will run through with the operator those options for presenting questions after the panelists have gone through their presentations. Each panelist will go through for about 15 minutes, and I am pleased to announce the first panelist, which is my dear friend and colleague, Judy Arbach. Judy Arbach is a public sociologist, independent scientist, and policy consultant, and adjunct professor at the School of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Judy has an esteemed career. She's worked for the past 25 years at the Nexus of Science and Policy, previously serving as Vice President Research and Evaluation at the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, Vice President for Public Policy and Program Development at AMFAR, Director of Behavioral and Social Science Program and HIV Prevention Science Coordinator in the Office of AIDS Research at NIH, Assistant Director for Social and Behavioral Sciences in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, and Senior Program Officer at the Institute of Medicine. Dr. Arbach received her PhD in sociology from the University of California, Berkeley. Go Bears. I also went to Berkeley. And has taught, presented, and published widely in the areas of HIV/AIDS, social science, public policy, and sex and gender. Judy's received numerous awards, all well-deserved, including the 2004 Feminist Activist Award from Sociologists for Women in Society and the 2006 Research in Action Award from the Treatment Action Group, TAG, and was named one of the PAWS 100 last year for her work on women and PrEP. Dr. Arbach's research interests focus on the social organization of scientific knowledge, specifically the role and standing of social research in the HIV/AIDS response, social determinants of health and well-being, and the relationship between science, program, and policy. So with that, I'll turn it over to Judy.
Thanks very much, and I hope you can hear me clearly. It's a pleasure being here, and I'm very excited about today's topic because it's been a long time coming. We've referred to risk of HIV infection since the beginning of the epidemic, but it turns out the construct is really not very well defined, particularly when it comes to women. So that's what we're going to focus on today as it relates to PrEP, but probably beyond that as well. So to begin with, as Anna mentioned and as you know, I'm trying to forward my slides, but it's not working. So next slide, please. The FDA approved pre-exposure prophylaxis in the form of oral Truvada, a pill a day, last year, and in the language announcing that approval, the FDA refers to PrEP being something appropriate for uninfected individuals who are at high risk of HIV infection. And in the CDC guidelines you see from this slide, the statement is that PrEP should be targeted to adults at very high risk for HIV acquisition. So we have high risk and very high risk, but these are not entirely well defined, as we're going to talk about right now. And next, please. Historically, as you probably all are aware, the CDC in particular has characterized risk according to a few broad categories, and these are male-to-male sexual contact, heterosexual contact, injection drug use, and male-to-male sexual contact and IDU and other. Of course, there's perinatal transmission and other blood-borne transmission that don't show up on this particular slide. But if we're focusing on sexual transmission and related drug use, these are the key categories by which risk has been characterized over time. Next, please. There's also been a calculation of how risky certain practices are that come under those broad categories. And so as you can see, the most efficient route of transmission has been blood transfusion, the most direct injection of HIV into the bloodstream. And these are arranged hierarchically, as are, if you could go back to the last slide, the categories of risk. Historically, and this is quite important, the CDC has hierarchically arranged risk so that if you are a woman who is engaging in heterosexual sex and injecting drug use, you would have been characterized as an injection drug user rather than someone who acquired or was at risk of HIV through your heterosexual activity. So that's important to know as well in thinking about the ways in which we've understood and characterized risk and defined who's at risk and in what ways over time. And if you could go to the next and actually the next one after that. What we know from epidemiologic data in the United States is that most women who have HIV infection are thought to have acquired it through, again, heterosexual contact, very broad brush category. And what's important about this categorization is that it conflates or it actually masks all manner of things that probably are important in determining whether one is at risk and how risky one's situation is. So it's conflating or it's masking sexual orientation, sex practices and specific behaviors, relationship types. There are a lot of different kinds of relationships that may relate differently to exposure and risk, and relationship dynamics, all of which may have different ways of affecting risk. Next, please. And two of those that may be particularly important for women are anal intercourse as a set of practices, and obviously with relational dynamics, and sexual violence. So I just want to mention those briefly as to make the point that these are only a couple of things that are masked, very important things that are masked by just characterizing women's risk as heterosexual transmission. So anal intercourse, as we know, is generally understudied and probably very underreported in studies in which anything is even inquired about it. We know that in developed countries, the transmission probability for unprotected receptive anal intercourse, that is what women would chiefly be engaging in, is estimated at about 18 times the risk for receptive vaginal intercourse. And even in Africa and the Americas and elsewhere, up to 20% or more of selected populations who've been studied have engaged, this is based generally on self-report, in anal intercourse, either forced or consensual. And, of course, it is important to note that anal intercourse can be either. In some probability sample surveys, we've seen as much as a third of U.S. women acknowledging that they've ever engaged in anal intercourse. And what's also very important is that condom use is often lower in heterosexual anal intercourse than it is in vaginal intercourse. And, again, as you recall from the slide on transmission risk probabilities, anal intercourse is much more risky with respect to transmission possibilities than is vaginal intercourse. The lack of condom use could increase transmission possibilities. We also know that anal intercourse, where it's coerced, is often in the context of some form of sexual violence. And so I'd like to turn to that for a moment. Next slide, please. Increasingly, there's been attention being paid to the role of sexual violence and all manner of sexual violence, from intimate partner violence to violence in the context of war and conflict situations, to make the point that there's ways in which risk of infection, acquisition of HIV from a male partner specifically can occur that have not been very well explored and that affect the physiological all the way through the social and are affected by the social all the way through the physiological. So, for example, we know from research looking at other studies or a range of studies about the role of intimate partner violence and risk of HIV infection that gender inequality and exposure to physical and sexual interpartner violence is associated with HIV infection rates of about increasing one's risk about 1.5 times. And similarly for other STIs, increasing risk as much as 3 times. So we know that intimate partner violence as a relational dynamic that operates through heterosexual intercourse, whether vaginal or anal, can increase risk of HIV infection, but that's often not captured in this broad brush category of heterosexual contact as neither was anal intercourse itself. So the point is, next slide, that risk occurs obviously beyond an individual. It's not just a possession or a characteristic of any individual woman. It's very much affected by her relationships, and those relationships take place in social contexts, including local social institutions like families and other community and social institutions, as well as broader social forces and factors. So the construct of risk really does apply and must apply at all levels of social organization, as you can see in this social ecological model, which is increasingly a way in which people are talking about HIV altogether, that we understand, I mean, social scientists, as you know, have been saying this forever, but the field broadly has finally come to accept and understand that any aspect of HIV must be understood in a social ecological fashion, that is, from the individual, even at the physiological level, in that individual, all the way up through the social dynamics, because these affect and are affected by each other. As the next slide makes clear, in another construct of risk, which is focusing on the environment and saying it's not just a woman who herself puts herself at risk by engaging in a particular behavior that may have, or practices with a partner that may increase risk of transmission, but she's affected very much by her physiology and her relationship dynamics as they exist in an environment that also can confer risk by not providing certain services, by not providing education about HIV and how it's transmitted and how to protect herself, by environments in which violence is very endemic, and so on. So this is a schema on this slide that was adapted by Stephanie Strassi from some work by Tim Rhodes and colleagues, connected chiefly to drug users, but very applicable to all populations, in which what we see is that if we focus on the risk environment, we see there are both endogenous, meaning factors that reside within something, in this case an individual, and exogenous, that is factors that reside outside that person in the environment, that interact from at a micro and a macro level, meaning everything from the genotypic characteristics of the host, that is the woman, and how that virus is going to get into her system or not, all the way through to and up to the environment and the social and cultural environment in which she lives, and how those are affecting each other through the action, which is a behavioral practice. So the point in all of this is that we can model risk in these different ways, and you can see different pictorials of it, but the point is that there's an interaction between individual, relational, institutional, and societal that must be understood and is not unidirectional. If we go to the next slide. And once we understand that, we can attempt to draw some causal pathways between these levels. And as you can see, it gets quite complex. It's complex theoretically, and it's complex methodologically to try to study them. And then it's complex if we try to discern interventions or policy changes. So this is a slide borrowed from Charlotte Watts, who and her colleagues, who were trying to look at the macro social at the top, some of the social factors that work through some of the relational factors involved in intimate partner violence that then translate eventually into the likelihood a woman is actually going to acquire HIV or not. And you can see the arrows going some directions. They probably could go in other directions depending on how you theorize these relationships. But the point being, when we account for all these interacting levels of potential risk, it becomes complicated to draw clear causal pathways between any individual or set of physiological, behavioral, and social risk factors and an HIV outcome. But just because it's complicated doesn't mean we shouldn't address it. And so all of this is going to be relevant when we think about which women under which circumstances may be at risk for HIV infection and therefore good candidates for pre-exposure prophylaxis, and how that will or will not be made available to them. So I wanted to just end, if you'll go to the last slide, with acknowledging people who provided me some slides and have affected my thinking about this, and I will turn it back over to Vignetta.
Thank you, Judy. That was amazing. And for those of you who haven't seen either in the chat function or weren't here on the beginning of the call, the slides will be available in PDF form on the website after this is done, because I know I, for one, love that last slide and certainly all of them. So thank you for your time, Judy. I have the pleasure of introducing our next speaker, Rebe Amico. And Rebe is a research scientist at the University of Connecticut Center for Health Intervention and Prevention, also known as CHIP. Her program research has focused on HIV prevention and engagement in HIV care for over a decade, with particular emphasis on real-world applications of social behavioral interventions and practice. She's worked domestically and internationally and currently is part of several research teams examining PrEP uptake, adherence, and persistence. And this isn't from your bio, Rebe, but I'm going to take the liberty of saying it. Anyway, I found this online about Rebe, and I really love this. Rebe believes the intersection between medicine, behavioral science, and systems of care offers the unique opportunity for health psychologists to actively contribute to multidisciplinary teams and shape the direction of behavioral interventions for promotion of health and clinical outcomes for those struggling with chronic medical conditions. And this is particularly the case in HIV care. So thank you for all the hard work that you do, and take it away, Reveille.
Thank you, and apologies in advance to everyone for my congestion, but I think we'll be able to make it through, and also for any delays I may have caused due to technical difficulties. Hopefully people can hear me okay. If not, certainly raise your hand or put it in the chat. I do have a lot of animations here, so whoever's flicking the slides, I'll just say next or click. So what I'm going to do is to talk a little bit about how risk has been defined, or I should say at-risk has been defined in some of the major PrEP studies, and then talk about some other aspects of risk or concepts of risk that are also increasingly important, as well as how it's been measured over time in different studies as well. So let's go ahead and get into it. Oh, thank you. Typically, when we think about at-risk women, right, if you think about VOICE, Partners PrEP, PRECA, TDF2, or FemPrEP, really the first ones that you see there, with FemPrEP maybe being a little bit different, all defined high risk, or women, I should say, that are participating in their study, the criterion for inclusion was really by way of being sexually active. And that may have differed in terms of, you know, sexually active in the past 3 months, in the past 30 days, TDF2 lists in the protocol sexually active, and FemPrEP lists at higher risk of becoming HIV infected, and that was defined as vaginal sex in the past 2 weeks or more than one partner in the past 30 days. So some of you that are familiar with the studies that are focused on MSM or even some of the demonstration projects going on right now will very quickly see that we probably have a little bit more restrictive criteria now than what was used in these studies. If you click to the next slide, thank you. And the reason for that is that most of these studies, if not all of these studies, were done in areas where the HIV prevalence was really very, very high, and that's what it is that really distinguished this as a risky group. So it's important to keep in mind that it was more the community levels of HIV that really placed these women at risk, and they were, but de facto, more at risk than someone who was not sexually active. But their behaviors in terms of being risky were not particularly behaviorally risky. It's simply, were you sexually active in an area where there's a lot of HIV? Can you click, please? Thank you. So at risk, by way of being sexually active in sexual and social networks and communities with high HIV prevalence, but that's not necessarily on the basis of risk behavior. Click. The way in which risk behavior tends to be, okay, we'll see how these slides pan out. The way in which risk behavior tends to be evaluated is somewhat myopically, if you think about it. It's really talking about gathering events, gathering event-based data. So these are surveys or interviews that typically assess some aspect of risk behavior, or a behavior that would put you at increased risk of exposure for HIV. So how many times did you have vaginal sex in the past month? With how many partners? Of those partners, how many were HIV positive? Of those positive partners, how many times did you have vaginal sex? And of those times, how many times was a condom used from start to finish? And that's just one example of kind of the question course that usually goes to generate these risk behaviors as well as higher risk behaviors. And that would be repeated for HIV negative partners and HIV status unknown partners. Can you go to the next slide? Oh, yeah, it's really not animating. So this is going to be particularly problematic. Do you have any idea why it's not animating?
Hi, everybody. This is Julian from Maybach.
Hey.
Unfortunately, the ReadyTalk interface does not support PowerPoint animations. So going to have to do our best without them, unfortunately.
Oh, boy. What a drag. Okay, you guys, bear with me. And then, you know what, maybe we'll make the slide stack available, and then you would actually see how this all makes sense, because I promise you, you'll have a couple of slides where you will have no idea what's going on, because they're animated. Okay, so no worries. Risk behavior, I also wanted to notice, or at least provide some information about how typically the survey and interview-based kind of what event happened with whom and was a condom use. there's a lot of innovations going around risk assessment, and a lot of that's happening with the ecological momentary sampling, and there's SMS text-based assessments, and you can see part of an image of Black Book there on the side, which is a phone app, which is used by, that was developed by Schneider and others in San Francisco, but it's essentially an app you would put on your phone that you could go through and detail, you know, the kind of sex that you had. You could even rate it and kind of make it a fun interactive process for people to also be collecting data. There's also SexPro that Susan Buchbinder's MP3 project is using, and that's an internet-based data collection tool. So I just want to put out there that even though there's these, you know, traditional measures which aren't really quite as exciting, more and more these based technologies are being leveraged to have a far more interesting way of collecting data and also a more real-time way of collecting data, because it could certainly be difficult to characterize, you know, how many people you had sex with in the last 30 days if you're quite sexually active or how many times. Can you go to the next slide, please? Today, and it's important to think about, you know, how risk is being assessed, because one of the main concerns with PrEP is going to be this aspect of risk compensation. So do people receive PrEP and then actually increase the amount of risk that they would have otherwise engaged in if they were not on PrEP? And I just want to note that we don't have evidence today, and you can pick from any number of studies. This slide is from Bain at all in the Partners PrEP study, where pretty consistently, this is the pattern that we see where people initiate PrEP in these clinical trials, and it generally decreases over time. The example here is the number of unprotected sex, so the number of proportion of participants reporting unprotected sex. I do want to note that more data is obviously needed because this is a clinical trial. It's a placebo-controlled clinical trial. So we don't know whether or not introducing PrEP, an effective strategy that may present, in fact, an alternative to other strategies that they were using, such as condom use, we don't know whether or not that might actually produce a different pattern here. But to date, so far, we haven't seen this compensation, but obviously more data is needed. Can you go to the next slide, please? So how at-risk is defined and how behavioral risk is defined and measured is really important. And one of the reasons that I think Dr. Harbaugh clearly presented is that it's folded into the guidelines for PrEP use as well as for demonstration projects. It's also relevant, as we just noted, for monitoring risk compensation and also for, you know, tracking prevention synergies. So perhaps the introduction of PrEP in someone's life, maybe it increases their use of other prevention strategies. But we need to be able to monitor that at an event level, preferably in real time, to best that we can. But perceptions of risk are also implicated in social behavioral models for the adoption of prevention practices. And what we construct as driving risk or determining risk, like Judy was talking about the pathways, really determines the targets of intervention activities and can influence policy focus. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about those last two points. So can we click? So this is all messed up slide, but suffice it to say, picture it this way. In health belief models, and also I would say just about any risk behavior model or decision-making model, positions risk perception as a determinant or a moderator of the adoption of the behavior or reduction of risk. You'll see on what should be your left-hand side of your screen a picture of, this is a model of the health belief model, and here you can see perceived susceptibility to a disease. So that would be, you know, how open am I to getting this disease, and perceived severity of a disease, how bad would it be if I did get it, and perceived threat of a disease. So, you know, what are really the odds of me getting it? All really interact to influence the likelihood of taking some kind of action to try and prevent the disease. And it's a little messed up looking, but if you look to the right side here, this is the class with Lazarus and Folkman coping response. So if you follow the chain here over on the far right, you need to be able to have some sense that a threat is present. Otherwise, you know, there's not going to be any action. There's no need for action. So if your primary appraisal of the situation is that there's really no threat to you, you're not going to take action because there's no threat, so there's nothing to act against. If you come over on the left-hand side of that block of the coping perspective, you can see that if you do appraise something to be particularly threatening, then you're going to most likely try to think about whether or not there's something you can do about it. And this block here is where it's particularly important, because it's not just recognizing that there's a threat there, but the perception of your ability to cope with that threat, your ability to do something about that threat, is really what will lead to positive stress or positive arousal that will lead to action. You know, the flip side is you could perceive yourself as being quite unable or unable to deal or cope with the particular threat. There's nothing you feel like you can do. That does actually lead to much more heightened negative stress, as well as an inability to kind of move towards productive action. Next slide. Oh, it was really pretty animated, Chesty. If you look at perceived risk, I think a lot of us would argue that it's a gateway to considering a prevention method. So it's one of those necessary but insufficient conditions for the adoption of the behavior. And it continues, as Judy was mentioning, to be pretty ill-defined when you talk about risk perception. So people talk about, you know, perceived likelihood, perceived risk, perceived susceptibility. Oftentimes they're used interchangeably, but they're actually distinct constructs. And overall, when you start talking about gender, that it's really important to think about these things in the social ecological framework that Judy just talked about. And again, there's multiple figures for what that might look like, but ultimately it really boils down to the fact that whether you're looking at events, whether you're looking at risk perception, all of these things are heavily nested within the norms, power, potential violence, dominance, even the risk ratio, and also, you know, who's executing the prevention strategy. These are all really critical parts to keep in place. And if you look myopically about events, you know, you don't really get that fuller picture. Next slide, please. That's going to be really hard to read. The causal pathways, hold on, let me do something really quick, apologies. So when we talk about causal pathways for HIV, for high-risk behavior among women, stand by. Now I can see it. Feeling at risk or threatened by or worried about HIV infection, it can't lead directly to the adoption of a prevention behavior if a strategy that you're considering is not in your control. And that's particularly important as you look at, I don't know if you can make it out, but on the right-hand side there is Jennifer Harmon's 2013 model that looks at power differential and power dynamics, as well as the different ways in which different sexes implement power in the process of a relationship. And that even, when you look at those meso-level factors and the micro-level factors, depending on what it is that's being asked to be executed, for example, condom use, and if we're talking about male condom use, we absolutely have to factor in the power dynamics between those individuals that are negotiating this. So when we think about at-risk, when we think about, you know, risk perception, we have to be talking about what strategy are we talking about, and is that strategy something that's actually in your control? The other piece is that we need to be very cognizant that there may be multiple more immediate and more negative consequences to individuals when faced with trying to negotiate sexual protection versus the prospect of getting HIV. So where it is that that power comes from, as well as what the consequences of trying to really assert one's power in that situation, absolutely needs to take a front seat in all of those conversations. One of the things that's interesting about PrEP is that it might actually offer a unique benefit to women as a self-administered strategy, you know, versus condoms or couples HIV testing or, you know, outward arrangements towards monogamy. Those things do have more of the power negotiation that needs to go on, but it's really not clear presently how privately one can uptake or adhere to PrEP, or if there's social harms related of non-disclosure of PrEP use, for example, to partners. Next slide, please. So constructions of risk and prevention among women require greater sensitivity to the relationships, to power, to the social contextual dynamics that really facilitate and challenge health promotion. And in order to reduce HIV among women, we really do need to aggressively identify effective female-centered options. And even with these options, risk reduction efforts should also emphasize the factors that propel risk, and that includes gender-based violence and inequitable gender norms, systematic discrimination that promotes poverty, and ongoing economic disparity and dependencies that really propel ongoing elevated risk among women. Next slide, please. Well, and just, again, thank you very much for the time to discuss this. I'm happy to discuss more, and apologies for that not being able to be animated. It will actually look a lot better when you're able to download it.
Thank you so much, Ravee, and I couldn't possibly begin to animate slides in the way that it even looks like you were doing in the screenshots that we had available to us. So thanks so much for the thought you put into that, and I think as participants, we certainly all got the gist and look forward to seeing animated slides in the future. With that, let me turn over to our final panelist, and then we can get into the Q&A. So our final panelist, Joanne Keatley, received a Master's of Social Welfare from University of California at Berkeley, another Cal grad. I think there's a disproportionate number of us involved in HIV and women in PrEP. At UCSF since 1999, Joanne directs the Center of Excellence for Transgender Health, which is a capacity building and technical assistance center. Joanne is the co-investigator of the new HRSA-SPIN Transgender Evaluation and Technical Assistance Project, TTAC. During the last decade, she's directed multiple federally funded research and HIV prevention projects and has consulted on transgender health at the NIH, CDC, HRSA, SAMHSA, and at the White House. Joanne's received numerous awards and recognition, including the first staff recipient of the UCSF Chancellor's Award for LGBT Leadership, and in 2009, the UCSF Martin Luther King Jr. Staff Award for Advancing Cultural Diversity and Social Justice on Campus. In 2011, Joanne was honored by Kaiser Permanente with the National HIV-AIDS Diversity Award. So thank you so much for that, and Joanne, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Bermuda. I appreciate the introduction. It's a pleasure to be here this morning, and I want to just thank the U.S. Women and PrEP Working Group members and Anna Forbes, who invited me to the webinar. It's such an honor to be among these esteemed speakers that came before me. Without further ado, let's get started with these slides. So next slide, please. So the Center of Excellence for Transgender Health, which I direct, our mission is to increase access to comprehensive, effective, and affirming healthcare services for trans and gender variant communities. And, you know, the work that we do is done as you members of a team, and the team there that is in front of your screen there are people that I'm very proud of working with. So, next slide. So next slide, please. Yeah. So this is a representation of the epidemiology that has been documented by colleagues Steph Burrell and others, looking at the worldwide burden of HIV in transgender women, a systematic review and meta-analysis. And you can see kind of where we've been able to document some of the rates of HIV among transgender women in particular. Next slide, please. So that meta-analysis included 15 countries, including the United States, 6 Asia-Pacific countries, 5 in Latin America, and 3 in Europe, with a total N of 11,066 transgender women. The overall prevalence rate among trans women was HIV. Overall prevalence was 19.1%, and the odds ratio for being infected with HIV compared with all adults of reproductive age across the countries was almost 49 times to 1. And participants in all of these studies that were looked at were much less likely to have access to and utilization of HIV services. Next slide. So I'm also going to be looking at the social, ecologic, classical model of health. And these are some of the HIV drivers according to that model. So policy, community, institutional, and then we split out the personal into interpersonal and intrapersonal as well. Next slide. So when we break it down to the intrapersonal, you'll see that we have internalized transphobia, low self-esteem, mental health, so mental health issues including suicidality and other mental health and behavioral health factors, gender identity validation through sex. Trans people often seek out validation through sexual activity. And then, of course, the multiple injection risks that people are exposed to. So injection drug use, injection silicone use, and then, of course, injection hormone use. And I might just add that in many of the places around the planet where trans women's HIV rates have been documented, there are not needle exchanges set up that have, that include needles for hormone use or silicone use. So even if there are needle exchange sites, they're not for the types of needles that transgender women are using regularly to affirm their sense of self. Then in the interpersonal, you see that I've also listed transphobia as one of the main drivers. And this can be transphobia in terms of other family members leading to family rejection, peer harassment, sibling harassment, high-risk sex partners, and all of the ways that our sex partners put us at risk. And then going on to institutional, again, transphobia we list. And institutional transphobia can take the place of, for example, just denying one the right and the access to safe bathrooms, access to health care, lack of educational opportunities because educational settings are not designed to respond to the needs of transgender people. Employment discrimination. Even in the U.S., there are only a handful of states that have employment non-discrimination laws in place protecting transgender women from employment discrimination. Housing discrimination. So many transgender women end up living in substandard housing, often single-room occupancy units, because they're denied the opportunity to rent housing. And then, of course, the overrepresentation in criminal justice settings, and then religion bias. Next slide, please. So once again, we have, when we look at community, we look at societal transphobia and all of the ways that trans people have to navigate that minefield. Things like having to get on a bus to go to an HIV clinic and being harassed on the bus. Arriving at an HIV clinic and having the receptionist use the wrong pronoun when they're referring to you, or refusing to use your preferred name, things like that. So the overdependence on sex work, and trans people, trans women often are in sex work as a result of denial of opportunities to educate themselves and then to participate in the workforce. So it's not always a decision that has been made because one chose the path, but because this was the only path that was available to them. And then, of course, the horrific rates of violence among trans women around the world, we're one of the few populations where we have an actual Transgender Day of Remembrance event on November 20th that is recognized around the planet as a day to commemorate the loss of lives on the planet merely because someone was transphobic and chose to take out their act of violence on someone who they perceived to be transgender or who they perceived to be challenging the notions of what it is to be a woman. And then, of course, substance use and the dependence on substance use and the kind of society that's built around substance use is primarily as a coping mechanism for the environment that so many trans women find themselves in. And then social stigma and the lack of role models, which really impacts one's ability to function well in society. And then, of course, policy. So institutional transphobia, not having any anti-discrimination policies in place, laws which make it very difficult to have name and gender changes, immigration laws that prohibit trans women to immigrate to the United States or, for example, to participate in marriages that would allow the spouse to immigrate to the United States. The policy arena has been changing dramatically in the last few years, but we have so much more room to go. Next slide, please. So transgender women living with HIV are also much less likely to receive good care. A study of four U.S. cities found that transgender women living with HIV were less likely to receive highly active antiretroviral therapy than a non-transgender control group. And this is one of the reasons why I am quite concerned about the use of PrEP among transgender women, is that we've traditionally been not provided with, you know, the best care. There are other reasons why trans women are being kind of left out of the care arena that I'll go into in another slide or two. Next slide, please. I wanted to share this data with you because I thought that it's kind of interesting. In San Francisco County, which has a pretty large population of trans women, a large population of trans women who are living with HIV disease. And I just wanted to give you a sense of what's happening here so that you can compare it to what's happening in other parts of the country. So one would argue that San Francisco is a welcoming environment and has been receptive and responsive to the needs of transgender women. I would say that that's a factual statement. We have a number of clinics in San Francisco that respond to transgender healthcare needs. The city and county government has been very responsive to inclusion of transgender healthcare issues. And yet we have here a situation where consistently between 2004 and 2008, transgender people represented at least 2% of the newly diagnosed AIDS cases. So you can see here below, the data here says transgender. These are all primarily transgender women. So you can see 2% across years, except in 2007 there was a 4% rate, and then back to 2% in 2008. Next slide, please. Now, when you look at this Kaplan-Meier survival curve for persons diagnosed with AIDS between 96 and 2008, what you see here is that the data show an extreme drop-off in terms of survival rates for transgender women. And the red line there, it represents transgender women. You can see that at about 150 months, a transgender woman has about a 30% survival rate compared to non-transgender women who are surviving, you know, a little better than transgender women, about, I guess, a little under 50% survival rate. But you could see the blue line, the aqua line there, males are surviving at a greater than 60% rate. And I think that this just demonstrates the difference in both adherence, access, and utilization of care in, you know, in a county that lots of people would argue is one of the best places for trans people to access care. Next slide. And this is just another way of looking at this data. So that San Francisco County trans epidemiology, so between 2004 and 8, trans people represented 2% of the newly diagnosed AIDS cases. However, in 2008, they represented 7% of the total mortality and consistently have been representing about 4% of the mortality. So to me, represents a real challenge in terms of thinking about engaging with and linking trans women into care and then retaining them in care. Next slide. So what are the barriers to quality care for trans people? And I think that that is one of the things that we should be thinking about. Certainly, trans women have other medical and social priorities. Often, it's the affirmation of self that is driving lots of trans women to seek care at all. And so, you know, we make the recommendation that in order to retain trans women into care, that there should be an offer of cross-sex hormone therapy along with the ARVs and other healthcare needs. The lack of regular contact with medical providers. So, you know, there's lack of medical screening, including HIV and STDs, increased morbidity, low life expectancy. There's challenging in accessing quality trans care. So that leads to self-medication, body modifications through the use of soft tissue fillers. There's been well-documented negative experiences with healthcare providers. There was actually a national study by the National Center for Transgender Equality of over 6,000 trans people, and about a third of the participants reported being physically or verbally harassed in healthcare settings. EMR, the electronic medical record, and the fields that are included in the EMR do not allow for capturing gender identity, sex assigned at birth, preferred pronouns, preferred names, and with the transition of so many of the healthcare settings into EHRs or EMRs, it really sets up a situation where the trans person is going to become even more invisibilized than they already are. Next slide, please. And then this is one of the primary concerns that I have around PrEP for transgender women is that we don't have enough participation yet in the clinical trials. Many of the trials that are that have been held have had small numbers of transgender women participants. This particular trial, this IPREX paper was presented in Rome by Mark Muscolini. This, in this paper, among 366 participants who identified as transgender or who used female hormones, there were, in fact, 11 HIV infections in the TDF-FTC group and 11 in the placebo group, indicating there was no effect on transgender women. Almost none of the transgender participants had had sex change surgery, so it can't be explained away by a neovagina presence. And the IPREX team did speculate that differences in PrEP efficacy between transgender and non-transgender participants might be explained by chance or by differences in patterns of PrEP use, sexual practices, or hormonal effects on drug transport in the mucosa. And those are all, you know, things that we can speculate about, but until we have more data and more participation in by trans women themselves in these trials, I think that it is risky behavior to make an overall recommendation that we start providing all trans people this hope that PrEP will be an effective strategy for them to use when HIV infection rates continue to be so high among transgender women. I'm concerned about giving a message that for a population who is not well received in healthcare settings, has difficulty accessing healthcare services, and continues to be at such high risk for HIV, that we provide them with this tool that they may not have access to, and that will provide them with a sense of false security. Next slide. So that brings me to my conclusion. I want to just end by saying that we certainly appreciate being part of this webinar. I think that it's a very interesting topic and one that I would like to continue to see be explored. I certainly appreciate, again, the U.S. Women and PrEP Working Group members, and thank you so much for having me be part of this discussion.
Thank you so much, Joanne, and thank you to all three of our panelists. I mean, if we're going to be pithy and succinct in one word, I would just say wow for all three of you. And if we were all in a room together, I'm sure you would be getting very, very, very loud applause. And so please know that this virtual room sincerely appreciates your time and effort on both these presentations, and also I'm sure there's many curious parties, myself included, who will want to launch into Q&A, because you have certainly successfully disrupted the notion that risk is simple. And we all in HIV have used high risk, low risk, you know, almost casually, and used some of these sort of simple categorical determinations to see, you know, who was high, low, medium risk. And you really challenge us to no longer see there's anything simple about it. And as we're launching into a world where our prevention toolbox, to use the sort of lingo of the day, has grown to include PrEP and then will likely grow to include other ARV-based prevention strategies in the future, we can't be using these simple notions of risk any longer. So with that, I would love to launch into the Q&A portion. I will ask the operator to go into the directions on how to do the Q&A, and then I will take moderator's prerogative and start with a couple of questions of my own after the instructions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You'll hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you'd like to withdraw your registration, press the 1 followed by the 3. Please note that you can also use the chat feature located on the lower left corner of your screen. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, for the audio lines, feel free to press the 1 followed by the 4. And you may chat your question by using the feature on the lower left corner of your screen. At this time, there appears to be no questions on the audio line. I'll turn it to you for any questions via the chat feature.
Thank you very much. I will launch with my first question as I'm seeing a couple come in through the chat feature. My first question actually for all of you is that you've all elected to put your presentations and certainly the notion of risk into a larger sociocultural context than beyond sort of the individual behavior of the individual woman, and I think that is certainly the direction that most participants on this call either function or go in their lives. But in order for us to better sort of calculate, you know, risk assessment and incorporate gender inequity and power, as you discussed, Ravay, certainly violence, as you discussed, Judy, and certainly this sort of the institutional discrimination that you discussed, Joanne, given the sort of silos in funding and the silos in the way we have to do our programmatic work and not just research, is it possible to sort of see a future where programmatically in research where we'll see sort of the woman in the context of her full life as we try to integrate PrEP into the world? And I'll ask for any of you to start, but since you're not in the room together, let's go in order. Let's start with Judy.
So, I'm sorry, could you repeat the actual question?
Yeah, so given the silos in funding and the silos in the ways that we do our programmatic work, is it possible?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, it's very difficult. This is Judy speaking. It's very difficult for scientists to get out of their disciplinary silos, much less the funders and program folks to get out of their silos as well. But I think we've seen an evolution over time, as all three of us mentioned in our presentations, that in looking at how we conceptualize risk for women, even how we conceptualize women, frankly, but how we conceptualize risk, everybody understands that we have to look at multiple levels of social organization. And there have been lots of developments over time in recognizing that how to operationalize it remains a bit of a problem scientifically, how you can simultaneously look at and address the physiological, the behavioral, the psychosocial, and the social. But there's been a lot of progress in that regard. So I think, you know, one example, the gender-based violence case that I mentioned and others have mentioned, we're seeing in the last few years a real attempt to look at how genital trauma, which is the sort of physiological reflection, relates, it happens in the context of certain kinds of practices, whether that's coerced anal intercourse or consensual vaginal intercourse, but how the genital trauma occurs in those practices that are reflective of the relationship dynamic. So what's the nature of the relationship between, in this case, the woman and the man? Are they partners for life? Are they short-term? Is it, you know, a violent situation, a coercive situation? Do they have multiple partners and so on? And how all that's affected by the context in which they're living. Is there a lot of HIV prevalence in the community, as Ravay was talking about? Is it a situation in which there's structural violence in their community, war, conflict, gun violence, whatever it might be? So that topic area, I think, has very much raised the profile of the interdisciplinary and inter-level conversation that everybody needs to have. And we do see that reflected. I think one concrete place we can look at that is this White House-convened interagency federal working group on gender-based violence or sexual violence and HIV that issued a report in September, and if you look at that report, you'll see the federal agencies talking about all the ways in which they are attempting to address all those multiple levels simultaneously. So it's a long-winded answer to say it's possible, it's difficult, but I think we're moving in the right direction.
That's great. Ravay or Joanne, anything to add?
Go ahead, Ravay.
I would just add briefly that I do think in terms of research opportunities and program opportunities as well, that increasingly, you know, we are looking at a packaged approach. I mean, you have your MP3 projects, you have other projects that are focused much more specifically on using more higher level interventions to be able to affect the risk and potential risk among women. You have the Stepping Stones intervention, which looks at really reducing gender-based violence, or some of Audre Pettifor's work, where you're trying to really reduce the economic disparities. So I'm personally very excited to see a lot of, or I should say some, at least, funded research that are really trying to move back on those causal pathways and to think comprehensively and carefully about what is really going to impact overall risk. So I would say, yes, indeed, it is possible, and it's starting to happen.
Great.
And I would echo those comments. I think that, actually, I'm very encouraged by the fact that there are increasingly organizations and agencies that are recognizing trans women as women and as people who should have policies and research and focus directed at our needs. So I certainly see this as possible, and I'm excited and optimistic about the future, actually.
Great. I love optimism, especially from a disruptive group, right? I'm going to switch to the chat questions to make sure that we get those into the Q&A, even though I have many more of my own. So the first one actually is, besides trans women, what other groups could we possibly speculate might have a higher risk of falsely perceiving susceptibility to HIV acquisition with PrEP use? Thoughts on that? I think it's inspired by your comments, Joanne.
Besides trans women, you said?
Mm-hmm. Yep. That was the question from the audience.
Yeah.
Are there any other groups that we would speculate?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, this is Judy, pretty much any group is theoretically at risk of perceiving a false sense of susceptibility. The way I understood the question, the person is meaning, do you think you'll be protected if you use PrEP?
Yes.
When maybe you wouldn't be entirely protected. That's going to be true for anybody if PrEP is not administered and taken up in the way it's known to be effective. That is, at this moment in time, taking a pill, Truvada, every day as prescribed.
Yeah. And
yeah,
so
I would
add
to that. It's hard not to be in the same room, isn't it?
It is. Why don't we go with Reve and then Joanne?
Well, I was going to echo that whole prevention misconception, you know, at least in the context of research trials. But then when we look at the whole fears of risk compensation, you know, that's largely driven by that you're going to adopt a method that's not as effective. But I do want to comment, though, that from the IPREX study, my understanding is that among those trans individuals, there was actually no levels of drug or PrEP detected, so among any of the 11. So the other thing is really being able to have some more targeted efforts, you know, with this particular group to be able to get a sense of, you know, is it something that's really interacting with, you know, hormones, or is it something there, you know, there's problems with uptake and adherence that are much more realistic limitations to the kind of protection that they would get. So I think the door's wide open. We need more research there as well.
I would agree with that. I think we do need more research. And, you know, the problem, of course, is that, you know, for transgender women, often, as I alluded to, the priority is affirming the sense of self. So having access to the cross-sex hormone therapy is much more important to trans women than any antiretroviral therapy. Or the other issue, of course, is that we haven't really fully looked at what is the effect of cross-sex hormone therapy along with ARVs or with PrEP. And so the notion of introducing yet another substance to trans women who are already on medication for affirming the sense of self with, you know, long-term, you know, in this case probably lifetime use of these medications along with the, you know, the need for the gender affirmation drugs, it has a lot of concern for me. I think that we need to really think through how we're going to have increased adherence among, you know, trans women participants. How are we going to make the drugs available to them? How are we going to provide training to the the providers so that they're doing so in a sensitive and engaging way. And, you know, how are we going to send the message home that this is not in lieu of, you know, the whole other preventive measures that exist out there? So, I don't know.
Yeah. I think that's great. I'm also, I'm being sensitive to the fact that we have 5 minutes left and we have at least five other questions in the queue. And so I would just ask that our esteemed panelists be as brief as possible while still answering the question. And then I'm just going to go down the queue really quickly. And if one person answers effectively, then I would just ask that you echo silently. So the next question, I think, relates specifically to your slides, Judy, transmission probability of unprotected receptive anal intercourse is about 18 times the risk of receptive vaginal intercourse in developed countries. Do you know of any studies that look at these numbers in developing countries in the context of transactional sex?
I can't quote particular studies, but I would surmise that the rates would not be very different because it's really about the activities. So if they're engaged in similarly, then the transmission risk is probably similar. But the addition of the transactional sex is interesting because that's another term that I think has to be interrogated a little bit. Risk is less about transacting than it is about what kind of activities engage because of the transaction. So again, is the sex consensual or is it coerced? Is there a condom used or is there not a condom used? And I don't think that varies that much by one location or another. I mean, in my personal opinion, all sex is transactional, but that's another story. And is that in the United States, women engage in transactional sex as do men in the same ways or maybe in different ways, but there certainly is transactional sex as most people understand it. That is the exchange of sex or sexual favors for material goods or drugs or money or whatever else. There's as much of that going on in the United States as there is anywhere else, and probably other developed countries as well. So I think all that is by way of saying that context matters, certainly cultural practices and norms matter, but the actual activities of sex with or without condoms with multiple partners or not, coerced or consensual, is what really matters.
This next question is for Reve. Reve, could you discuss what we've heard about the failure of FemPrep due to women's lack of adherence? Anna also mentioned this in the introductory slides, and because of their lack of perception of risk. And how can we interpret the results of FemPrep in a more nuanced way?
Yeah, I mean, certainly. So with FemPrep as well as with Voice, you know, predominantly the futility, you know, is thought to be secondary to non-adherence. And certainly some people have hypothesized that that has to do with people not feeling particularly at risk. For example, I believe FemPrep, and I don't know if someone's listening from that state, but I believe FemPrep had about 70% of individuals felt themselves to be at low or medium, not at high risk for HIV infection, despite the high prevalence rates in the communities that they sampled from. And so there was this hypothesis, is this hypothesis, that perhaps people need to have this acute feeling of being at risk in order for them to be adherent, kind of like the models that we were talking about. However, I just want to reiterate that we assessed, you know, what's the likelihood of you getting HIV infected in the next month is typically how these questions pan out. And so that's actually perceived odds of infection, which might be very different than your perceived susceptibility. It might be different than your perception of efficacy to be able to do anything about it. It certainly might even not factor in a situation where the benefits that you're getting or the negative consequences that you would get from advocating, you know, for a change in risk is... Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm trying to talk fast. It's very difficult. let me put it this way. That really, I do believe that is not as nuanced an understanding that we need to have. And that's particularly because in some of these studies, the populations were able to access a lot of resources. And Jonathan Stradler and others have written a lot about this. And it's this great use of medical anthropology where they talk about how Even the participation of women in these studies has really challenged local and traditional gender norms and received a ton of pushback from the community. So there's a ton of stuff going on at a social cultural level that may or may not boil down to straight up adherence. So I think perceived vulnerability is important, but once you put it in the larger social context of what's going on, who am I in this trial, who am I as a participant in this trial, what pushback am I getting, whether or not you take the product is much, much bigger than simply looking at, you know, are you motivated to execute?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that leads nicely into what I'm going to say is the final-ish question, because I'm being sensitive to people's time and we have actually hit the 12:30 mark. But considering that all of you have talked of the context of violence throughout your presentations, there's a question from the audience on have there been any consistent interventions applied to in domestic violence shelters around HIV risk and certainly the interaction with integration of PrEP?
So this is Judy. I don't know if I'd say they've been consistent, but I know just in recent days, folks at Rutgers University, Courtney Kavanaugh, I think is one of the leads, are using the SISTA intervention, which is developed by Gina Wingood and colleagues at Emory, that focuses on HIV prevention, particularly among African-American women of varying ages and rural and urban and so on. But they're using that intervention as a basis for developing, for adapting programs for women in domestic violence shelters. So I think there is some concerted work, and I would suggest you look at that.
Excellent. And again, in the interest of time, I'm going to ask this final question, and then there are some requests for more information that I'll ask for participants to potentially put on the site. But there was one question from participant on is there any information on the long-term side effects of taking PrEP for an extended period of time that any of the panelists could discuss?
I'll chime in just quickly. I mean, I obviously not for the purposes of PrEP, and that's really going to be a question that we're going to continue to collect data on. What they do have is, you know, the long-term and the safety-type data for individuals living with HIV taking at least Truvada, which is the only one that has the indication right now in the U.S., but in terms of actually taking it for PrEP and the purposes of PrEP, I do not think that we have that. Do other people know that?
Just the IPRED Olay study is showing very little side effect and no long-term damage from taking PrEP for as long as those people have, which would probably be, what, 3 years?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. All right, so then the final request for more information, which we can follow up on the website, are, Reveille specifically, you listed a number of interventions that people might go to for more information, and there was a request to list either on the website or perhaps as an addendum to the PDF where what those interventions were and perhaps where people might be able to access the study results if possible. Another request, and thank you. And then another request for information was for Anna in terms of the U.S. Women in PrEP Working Group. Discuss a lot about a number of dependent areas in order to have some success for integration of women in PrEP. And we would just ask that those either be, again, an annex to the presentation or that we'll list them on the website in the interest of time. And so I will ask if, again, sort of the prerogative of the speaker to say that I thank you all for your time. And when we were discussing as a panel and a moderator, the use of the word disruptive, I think you have all been appropriately disruptive and challenged us to think better. So disruptive in the best of ways and think better and harder and more complex. About notions of risk as we integrate or not pre-exposure prophylaxis into the HIV prevention toolbox for women. And thank you for your speakers, for your time, and for the U.S. Women in PrEP Working Group for organizing this webinar, and for all of you hundreds of participants on this call for your active engagement, and hopefully you've learned a lot. Again, thank you very much.
Thank you, moderator.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you all for your participation and ask that you please disconnect. Thank you once again. Have a great day.